Ruth chapter 4, it should be about 223, 224, something like that in your pew Bible. If you'd like to follow along, it would probably be a good idea to do that. It helps as I kind of go through text here, and I just try to tell you what this says. So it's that's it. There's not much else to it. So that's what I'll do. We have been working our way through the book of Ruth for the last 4 or 5 weeks, and we come now to chapter 4, where we have the redemption applied. I'm going to begin reading in verse 1 of chapter 4. Chapters are the bigger numbers, and the verses are the smaller if you're not used to looking at a Bible. Now, Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the Redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, "Turn aside, friend, sit down here." And he turned aside, and he sat down. And he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit down here." And so they sat down. Then he said to the Redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there's no one beside you to redeem it, and I come after you." And he said, "I will redeem it." Then Boaz said, "The day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead and his inheritance." Then the Redeemer said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it." Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself," he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. And Ruth the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead and his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from among the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day." Then all the people who were at the gate and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthy in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception. And she bore a son. Then the woman said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer. May his name be renowned in all Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than 7 sons, has given birth to him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nahshon. Nahshon fathered Solomon. Solomon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. Father David. Redemption. Redemption. I've noticed one thing since I have moved up here in the 3 years now I've been living in New York. These things called redemption centers, right? Like where I come from, this would be like a hip church. Here, it's where you give tin cans, aluminum cans. And I've always wondered, how do they make money? Like, how do these things work? And so I needed to find out because I just am boggled by this whole process. I don't know how it works. Well, this is every. Then I just like went into the internet wormhole, and then found out everything there is to know about aluminum cans. And now I have to share it with you because that's literally just how I'm wired. So here you go. Beverage companies began using aluminum cans in 1959. The first soda to use an aluminum can, RC Cola. That's right. Today, 100 billion cans are produced in the U.S. every year. 100 billion cans. 100 billion. That's a lot of soda, right? And if you think about how much that would take up in like a landfill, that's a lot of trash. Except it rarely finds its way there. Aluminum cans are the most recycled and recyclable material in the world. Every day, 105,000 cans are recycled every minute in the U.S. Basically, to take an old can and make it a new can, it takes 60 days. It's theoretically possible that if you buy a Mountain Dew, every 2 months you're buying the same can with just new drink in it. In fact, 75% of all the aluminum ever produced in the United States is still actually in circulation from the beginning of us producing aluminum. It's absolutely incredible. And so these recycling centers are everywhere. And they only make 5 cents. Right? And I'm like, how does this add up? Well, here's what I found out. So they pay you 5 cents, but they sell that same can for 8.5 cents. To one of these processing plants, and the one for us is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. So they give you 5 cents, then they sell it, and they get 8.5 cents. One of these centers, on average, does 1,000 cans a day. So all said and done, or does $1,000 worth of exchanges a day. On average, these things make $365,000 a year. The overhead is like a hole in the wall, and like 4 employees. This is awesome. I'm contemplating career changes. But it's fascinating. You have this wasted can. It's useless. It's empty. And then it can be turned into something full and new all over again and redeemed. And it's like what we've seen in the book of Ruth. At the beginning of the book of Ruth, we're presented with Naomi and with Ruth, widows. They're homeless. They're hungry. They have no family. They have no friends. They feel used up. And now we come to the end, and they have been redeemed, and they are full. And it is God who has redeemed them. And that's what we're going to see this morning as we go through our final chapter of Ruth. The big idea for this text that I read is we see redemption, but we also see the goodness of God. That the goodness of God, his hand is all over this book. We've seen it all throughout the book. And now we see it again here at the end. The redemption and the goodness of God. I'm going to start going through the chapter here in verse 1 as we look at redemption plan. That is, how did we get to where we are? Well, in our previous chapter, we saw, and you can go back and read this afternoon or however, that Ruth had begun working in the fields, gleaning, that is, taking that was dropped and was left over, picking it up and using it to feed Naomi. This was a practice that was done, set up for widows, set up for sojourners, set up for basically orphans so that they could have food. It was like a social safety net. Well, Ruth makes her way into Boaz's field, and Boaz begins to take care of her. And he takes care of her because he's heard about all that she's done for her mother-in-law. And then he begins to feed her and give her way more food than she ever would have gotten. Essentially, Boaz begins to feed and take care of both Ruth and Naomi. Well, in chapter 3, we see that Naomi has a great idea as a mother. She's going to marry off her daughter. Here's a rich young man. He doesn't have a wife. let's get her married. And she concocts this crazy scheme that we talked about in a lot of detail last week. And if you want to hear it, like, go on the internet, because I'm not going to re-preach last week's sermon. I preached long enough as it is. And essentially, she's got the scheme. And at the end of the scheme, what Boaz does, Boaz says, I will find this out tomorrow. And then Naomi basically says, do not worry about it. On this day, he will not rest until he figures out what he's going to do. Because Ruth and Naomi want Boaz to marry Ruth. But legally, there's someone else in line before Boaz in the way that this redeemer system worked. And the redeemer system basically worked like this. Every family had someone who was a redeemer, and it was like a lineage line. And basically, it was someone who was either a brother or a close relative at this point. And what they had was they had the obligation or the right to your land. If you go bankrupt, they can buy your land and let you live on it and help keep your land in the family name. If you are a widow and you die, those who are your redeemers have the option to marry you to perpetuate the name of your family, and so that the widows could have a family, could have a house, could have a support system. The problem was there was somebody else who had the right to have Elimelech's land, and there was somebody else who had the right to marry Ruth ahead of Boaz. Now, and so it says here in verse 1 of chapter 4 that now Boaz had gone up to the gate and sat down there. Now, we know that this was not Boaz's original plan or the original way he wanted to spend his day. Because if you look in the chapter before, which is the night before, it says Boaz had fallen asleep down at the threshing floor. Basically, what he does, you work all day, and then you take what you've bashed out in your grains and your barley, you take them down to the town, you sell them, and then you go back at night, you eat dinner, and you sleep right there. So first thing in the morning, you start working again. So when he went to sleep at the threshing floor, it was his plan to work all day and not go to the town. He had just been in town. But chapter 4, verse 1. Says that basically when he woke up, he went straight down to the gate. He called in sick, if you will, and he went down to solve the situation. He wanted to marry Ruth. He wanted to redeem them, and he wanted to find this out immediately. And so it says he went down to the gate and he sat down. Now, the town gate here was basically where business was done. It was like a small, like, county courthouse, if you will. The gate was where transactions was done. It was where contracts were done in front of. It was where people could be married in front of the elders. It was where you had to go if you wanted to get a divorce, if you wanted to complain against a crime. Sort of all this stuff sort of happened at the gate where all of the elders sat around. When I was a kid, all of the elders would sit around Hardee's in the morning. And so I assume in my mind this is some sort of like thing like that. And so they're all down there, and so Boaz goes and sits down, and behold, the redeemer of whom Boaz had spoken came by. This was the relative that is a closer relative than him to Naomi's husband, deceased husband. And so he goes down there this morning, and he said, so Boaz said in verse 1, turn aside, friend, sit down here. Now, this is the only person that is unnamed who is a main character in this book. Doesn't have a name. Our Bible translations, the ESV and the NIV, they say friend, but that's not actually what it says. In fact, what it literally says is a placeholder name. It's like, it's basically a character named Mr. X or John Doe or Mr. So-and-so is how different commentators have referred to it. Essentially, they gave him some sort of anonymous caricature name. Now, there's disagreements whether this name was given because they wanted to diminish our respect for him, that he wouldn't do the sacrifice necessary like Boaz did. Boaz is a man of character. This is a man who is selfish, so they wouldn't even give him a name. And it was thought in the ancient Near East that to have a name forgotten is basically to be forgotten, and there was very few things worse than being forgotten. That's why family names and lineages were so important. And so they won't even name the guy. Basically, they're wiping away his existence. So that's a possibility. Or maybe it's just because it's not a big deal. I don't know. Which one? You can decide as you want. And so Boaz comes to this unknown redeemer, this Mr. X. And he says, turn aside and sit down here. And the man turned aside and he sat down. In verse 2, he says he took 10 men of the elders and he told them to sit down. So they sat down. Now, we know if you as you keep going, like over in verse 4 and into verse 11, a crowd actually starts to gather around. Boaz is calling all these people off the street that he needs, and other people are like, hey, I wonder what's going on. So they like rubberneck, and then it's like, well, I'm just going to show up and watch. It's like the people who go and just sit in court cases but have no reason to be there. I was on a jury duty one time, and there's just people in there. They're just listening to trials. Why? Man, watch Law and Order. Like, why am I going to show up? This is weird. But whatever. So that's what the guide does. So all these people are here as Boaz begins this transaction. And so this is what he says in verse 3. He said to the Redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, then redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there's no one beside you to redeem it, and I come after you. So he's basically beginning to lay out what he's trying to do. He's beginning to lay out what he's trying to do. Now, it's important in how he phrases this. So he says, I'll redeem it. And then Boaz gives the, oh, wait, there's more, like a game show host, right? But there's more. The day you buy that field, he says, from the hand of Naomi, you acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of the dead. So it's like, you get to buy this field and you get a wife, man. The guy's single. He maybe knows not wanting that at the moment. He didn't get to pick his wife. His parents don't get to pick his wife. No, he just gets a Moabite. And as we've learned, as we've read through the book of Ruth, the Israelites and the Moabites were not on the best of terms. Remember, they had just been in a lengthy war that they've only had a few years of peace. But memories seem to run deep when people are at war with each other. People seem to have long, deep memories that go generations when you've been at war. And so the fact that she's a Moabite would have probably turned him off anyway. But the fact he also would have had to have taken a wife, probably not what he was looking for that morning as he went to town. And then it continues, in order to perpetuate the name of the dead and his inheritance, not only do you get to marry Ruth, or have to marry Ruth, he says, everything her children have is not actually yours, it's hers. So when you die, all this land you buy, plus all the land you already own, actually will be in her clan and not yours anymore. So you get this field, but you get a wife, and one day you lose actually everything you own, and it'll go to Elimelech's clan and not yours. So this guy started off that he was going to get a field for cheap. And the next thing he has, he's got a wife, and he's going to lose everything he owns. It's like a country music song. So what does he say? Then the Redeemer said in verse 6, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take the right of redemption for yourself, for I cannot redeem it. It's almost like, oh, no, you, please. Please, Boaz, please take it. I insist. He backs away from his earlier enthusiasm. He doesn't want to help and be the redeemer that he's supposed to be or can be. He looked out for his own interest. Now, as you read Ruth and you see what happens, who the line that comes through their child was, how it leads to King David, what this unnamed redeemer was, he was so worried about his own name and his own inheritance that he completely missed out on being in the lineage of King David and being remembered for all time. And even more important, being in the lineage of Jesus Christ. He was only thinking about the now, the right now, and was paying no attention to the future, to the world to come, to the time to come. This was going to be a hardship for now, and he was not willing to go through it. And it is often that hard decisions, hard times, hard things can often bring about the best outcomes. Mr. X doesn't want to deal with this right now, but Boaz does, and Boaz is rewarded. As we look at this and think of an application for ourselves, we have to realize that There are some times that when you're going through a hard situation, keep going. Right? It very rarely benefits us to quit. I've met very few people who quit in like high school in 11th grade because they didn't like algebra 2. And now that they're in their 30s, thought, man, that was the best decision I ever made. I'm so glad I didn't graduate high school. I mean, as I looked, and this was a family member of mine, and I'll be fairly vague. She's 2 years younger than me, just graduated because that's what she did. So at 30 years old, two kids, goes back. But for 14 years, she lived with regret. She wouldn't just stick it out. It very rarely benefits us to quit in hard times. God's strength will lead us. Well, that's the plan. This is what happens. This is how Boaz begins to make sure that he can be the Redeemer. Now we look in verses 7 through 12, and we see that the Redeemer, he follows through with what he says he's going to do. Now, verse 7 is obviously strange because in verse 7, the writer actually gives us kind of why this took place. It's one of these great times in the Bible where it explains itself, and it makes my job very easy. He says, now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, the one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other, and this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the Redeemer said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. So that's what that means. There you go. Understand, it's weird. This is even weird to the writer of Ruth that this took place, and he's having to explain because obviously by the time the writer of Ruth is writing this, if it is really Samuel, then we don't, then it's not even a custom anymore. So that's why he explains it. And so he does that in verse 8, and he says, buy it for yourself. And then in verse 9, Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon, and also Ruth, the Moabite, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife to perpetuate the name of the dead and his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brothers and from the gate of his native place. Now, I do want to caution us quickly here for just a minute before we begin to think that he bought a wife, like something on the computer. That's not what happened. What he bought was the right to marry Ruth. He purchased that right of, hey, I am going to redeem the land, and I'm going to be the one who's going to redeem Ruth so it doesn't pass to who's after him. So basically what he's doing is he's stepping up to be the redeemer at this point. And by buying the land, he also is buying the right to marry Ruth. And since Ruth wasn't actually an Israelite, I mean, she could have just left. But she doesn't, because if you remember from chapter 3, she asked Boaz to marry her. So we already know that's what he wants. So hopefully that helps us get some context here with what's going on. And so it says, though, that he's going to marry her, and he's going to do this. And he says to all the people, at the end of verse 10, you are witnesses this day. And then verse 11 and 12, we get a lot going on here. All the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who built up the house of Israel. Okay, this makes sense. We know who Rachel and Leah are. They are the wives of Jacob, and we understand that they gave him his children, and they were the founding mothers of all of Israel. So that's good. That's like a good thing. And then he says, who built up the house of Israel. Then if we skip on verse 12, it gets kind of weird. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. All right. So unless you're going through your Bible reading for the year and you've just hit this, this is probably not a very familiar reference to many of you. All right. So what is this a reference to? Well, in Genesis 38, we have a similar situation to Ruth, okay? Essentially, Tamar's son, husband, died. Judah was the father-in-law, and Judah didn't do what he was supposed to do and find her a husband to continue the Levite rule. So he didn't do what he was supposed to do. So Tamar, and I'm going to be as clean as I can here, tricked Judah into, I think the word today is hooking up. And the result was twins, in which we have Perez was one of the twins, and he's the one through whom the line goes to Boaz. Well, this seems as though something that would not be brought up in the middle of a blessing from a whole group of people wanting your family to succeed. Hey, we hope you're great, just like your ancestors who did some super shady stuff. Like the kind of stuff that in 1 Corinthians gets you like kicked out of the church kind of stuff. Like that doesn't seem like something we want to accentuate, right? It's not like you're putting that on Facebook. It's not what you're doing. So why is this here? Well, first, because it explains where they came from. It draws a family line, okay? It gives us some context for the where Boaz comes from. Secondly, it's important because the Bible doesn't shy away from the more uncomfortable realities of life. If you read the Old Testament, most of the patriarchs and the Old Testament saints are pretty shady people. Right? David, the man after God's own heart, committed adultery, then killed the lady's husband. All right, that's pretty messed up. Saul, the first king of Israel, at the end of his life, besides trying to kill David, used to visit like mediums, like a tarot card people. You ever wonder who go to those people? King Saul. Don't be like King Saul. Right? That's what's going on. So Abraham told the Pharaoh of Egypt when he was living there that his wife was actually his sister because he was afraid that he might be killed and he might take him for his wife. Instead, Pharaoh paid Abraham for the rights to marry her, and he took the money and gave his wife to Pharaoh. I mean, this is stuff that if this is on TV, like, you don't watch, right? This is a movie, you boycott stuff like this, right? It'd be on HBO. You can't do this. This is in the Bible, though. Why? Because the Bible shows the truth and the realities of life, good and bad, because it's a true book telling a true story about a messy humanity. And when we read the Bible, we should have a bit of comfort knowing, as messed up as we are, we're not the first people to be this messed up. There's a whole long line of people who were messed up that God used and that God redeemed. And that's a good thing. But he gives this story, this line here, helping us know where he came from, where they came from. And then what does it say? Because of the offspring the Lord will give you by this young woman. Now, this is very important. This is not the offspring that the Lord will give to her deceased husband. He said that the Lord will give to you. What has happened here, and I'm getting this from Daniel Block, who wrote a great commentary on Ruth. And basically, what is happening is, yes, the son will be in the lineage through Elimelech. But because of the outrageous generosity and selfless love that Boaz had done to the town, that's also his kid. That he's not going to lose his inheritance. That it's not like he's going to be raising someone else's kid that will have someone else's last name. They're saying, nope, he's just as much yours. And this was not normal in the redemption world. Basically, because of how good and loving and sacrificial Boaz had been, all of the town rewarded him for his offspring. And the point through all of this, I want us to see, and that I've been looking at all month, is how Boaz is a pointer to Jesus. Boaz is a pointer to Jesus. Boaz, through selfless love, followed through to redeem Ruth. He followed through. It's not like Boaz, all right, great, now I get to redeem you. And it's not like he got cold feet and said, you know what? I'm out. He didn't do that. Boaz followed through. And it's a pointer to Christ that also followed through in his redemption of us. Do you remember Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane? He's sitting there and he's sweating, and this sweat was like drops of blood. And he says, "Lord, if it is possible, take this cup from me, but nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done." In the moment of truth, he didn't run. He endured pain. He endured, as the song we just sung, the wrath of God, so that he may redeem and could redeem his people. Like Boaz, Jesus' love is not incomplete. Many people in this room have scars from dealing with a life or experiences from those who have let us down, those who have harmed us, those whose love was not true, those who did not follow through with what they were supposed to do or who they were supposed to be. But Jesus doesn't do that. One psychologist says one of the hardest experiences to heal from is that of abandonment or being let down by those whom we trust. This creates several reactions, but primarily they produce fear and shame. Fear to build relationships because then we might be hurt again, and shame thinking we're not important or we're not of value. And what happens is this experience of being let down, of being broken, of having things ripped from you can scar you for a long, long time. But Christ is the one who can help overcome those barriers that we build from years of hurt, from experiences of pain. That the peace of Christ is a hope to settle our fears and cover our shame. Like Jesus says in John 14:21, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give to you. Not as the world gives do I give it to you." He says, "Not let your hearts be troubled, nor let them be afraid." That when we are healing or trying to heal or dealing with scars and pain and hurt, the answer is not to run away from people. The answer is to run towards Christ. And then we run towards the Redeemer, the one who heals. It is then that we can begin to build those relationships again. So let us run to God always. Finally, I want to spend just a few moments looking here at the line of redemption. The line of redemption. In verse 13, we see what takes place. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. First, I want to look at this. She became his wife. Now, it's thought that this wedding took place right here. Right? That right here, you know what? Hey, I'm going to marry her. Boom. And he just marries her right there on the spot. A shotgun wedding without the gun. So he marries her. She becomes his wife. We do live in an age and in a society where typical thoughts of marriage have become divorced from a biblical or Christian understanding, where marriage is distorted. Marriage is thought of today by most of society as a private alliance between two people that can be made or terminated as they wish. But with Christians, a marriage, a wedding, it is... the whole deal is a serious and it's a joyous occasion, right? Where a man and a woman before God and his people are brought together. See, God has an interest in marriage. Why? Well, he invented it. He has an interest. And God's people have an interest in marriage. Because what you're doing when you're married, you're saying to God and your community, that, hey, we're joining you as a family. We are going to be here, and we promise to do this. And you're promising to help us to do this. See, one of the reasons that we decry as Christians so many times the state of marriage in our culture is we've done it to ourselves. I mean, it's easier to get out of a marriage than a cell phone contract. And the church has been silent. When someone is struggling in their family, is the church there to help, or does the church ignore the problem? Well, that's their business. Well, yes, it is their business. But we also are to be here to help them to work it out. To be a resource, to pray with them, to set an example for them. Society didn't ruin marriage. We did. We've said nothing and have tried to help nobody for decades. We have only ourselves to blame. But that is not how it has to be. That we can show the world that marriage is good and that it is pure and that it honors God, and we can show that it can work in an age where less and less people get married. I think last year the marriage rate is the lowest it's ever been because millennials have given up because they've seen it fail in their parents. The church can show that it works, and we must. He continues in verse 13. It says, he went into her, and the Lord gave her a conception, and she bore a son. She bore a son. Conception. God is pro-life. The Lord gave her conception. Every conception is given by the Lord. In a world where life is completely disrespected, where abortion is common, children today are seen more and more as a burden than a blessing. Just a few weeks ago, Time magazine had on its cover The Childless Life, and it was a choice showing how we didn't have kids. That way we can do whatever we want. But that is not how it works. Christianity contradicts and flies in the face of this. This text tells us that God creates life, and we should see life as a treasure. Children are a blessing from God, and they should be cherished as such. You see, too many times we want to be pro-life. We say we should be pro-life. But what do we often do, even not even thinking sometimes, is we treat single parenthood as though it's some sort of sin. It is not. There's no sin in being a single parent. There's no sin in having a child while you're not married. In fact, you've done the good thing by not aborting. See, we can cry that we're pro-life all we want, but what do we do with that? How do we treat those who have done the righteous thing? And how do we love those who do not? Every child that is conceived bears the image of God. We must protect that. One biblical scholar wrote, by the ordinance and gift of God here in this text, a new life is conceived, a fresh creation, a life quite unique and irreplaceable, a specific, identifiable person. We must see all people that way. Look at verse 14. Then the woman said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you is more to you than seven sons has given birth to him. Look at the relationship between Naomi and Ruth. The relationship between Naomi and Ruth started as they were two people from two different ethnicities, two different cultures, two different languages, two different religions. When Naomi goes back to Israel, she tells Ruth not to come. And then all of a sudden through the book, it transitions that she goes from being called her daughter-in-law to Naomi refers to her as her daughter. And now at the end of the book, it says that she was more precious to Naomi than seven sons. The statement that as the readers read this in this day and age, that would have been an amazing statement to make. An amazing statement. And she says she's more worth more to her than that. And it says Naomi took the child in verse 16 and laid him on his lap, laid him on her lap and became his nurse. And the woman of the neighborhood who we saw earlier over in verse 1 when she said, "Don't call me Naomi, call me miserable." Actually, here the women are back. And the women of the neighborhood name him, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi," and they named him Obed, who was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And we see this line continue through. It's important to understand some things here. Boaz is a redeemer. He's a Goel. That means Boaz's son would also bear the inheritance as a redeemer. And on and on and on. Throughout his line, every male would be a redeemer. David was used by God to redeem the nation of Israel that had fallen under hard times because of the rule of Saul. Been turned away. But David would come and he would help pull together Israel and be used by God. But even greater than David is Christ, the great redeemer of mankind, who comes through this line, who redeems not just one woman, but who can redeem all. Can redeem all. Christ is our great redeemer. Christ is the one who can heal us. As Romans 3:22 says, "It is the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe, for there's no distinction. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and we are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith." This was to show God's righteousness because in his divine forbearance he had passed over former sins. It was to show his righteousness at the present time that he might be the just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. When we put our faith in Christ, our Redeemer, we are justified. We are saved. Our sins are forgiven and we have inheritance in the kingdom of God. We are redeemed as in we are brought into the family of God. Our Redeemer makes us his offspring, just like Obed was Boaz's, became his. That when we come into faith with Christ, we become part of the family of God. We are adopted as his children, that we are sons of God and daughters of God. No matter where we come from, what we have done, that's what this whole story is pointing to. It doesn't matter where you come from. It doesn't matter what your past is like. It doesn't matter what you look like, what you talk like, what you sound like. Nothing matters. To God, what matters is faith. Will we be as Ruth does? Your God is my God. I will not forsake him. Or do we continue in our own way? If you're in here this morning and you have faith in Christ, you believe the gospel, we should rejoice that we have been redeemed. A plan that was started thousands and thousands of years ago and was started even before the book of Ruth. We rejoice in that. We should be thankful for that. We're about to take the supper. And as we take the supper, that's what we're remembering, what God has done for us. And if you're not a Christian, if you're not sure where you are, you're still trying to figure out, I urge you to look to Christ. Don't try to find redemption on your own, for he is the only one who can bring what our soul needs. Let's pray.